From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The columnist E.J. Dionne says the American conservative movement was a perfectly reasonable political enterprise until about 50 years ago. That's when it took a wrong turn. And I know what you're thinking. Of course, Dionne would say that. He's an unabashed liberal. He does cop to that, by the way, in his new book. But he has a soft spot for an earlier version of conservatism. He used to be one, first of all. And he writes about how the movement in the 50s, for example, was balanced and measured. But right around 1964, he says the Republican Party and conservatism began this steady march rightward. And the polarizing Donald Trump, he says, is one of the fruits of this cycle of radicalization. Dionne is joining us today to make his case for why he says the right went wrong after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's how the political commentator E.J. Dionne begins his new book. The History of Contemporary American Conservatism is a story of disappointment and betrayal. It's quite a start. And here's his theory. For 50 years now, conservative politicians have been making promises they haven't been able to keep. So the rank and file is angry. Conservative leaders kept telling their base that they were going to make government smaller or repeal this or overturn that, and a lot of that didn't really happen. In his book, Dionne says the sense that their leaders had failed them created this cycle of radicalization. He says you're seeing elements of it in the campaign speeches of Donald Trump, for example. Earlier today, we spoke with E.J. Dionne about his book. It's called Why the Right Went Wrong, and in it, he offers an historical view of conservatism. He makes the case that modern conservatives revisit and reverse that wrong turn they took some 50 years ago. We began our conversation with the obvious disclaimer that the person making this case is an unapologetic liberal, the one who used to be a proud conservative.
I make a point of, A, being honest about where I'm coming from at the beginning, but also talking about, how I grew up, because I think it's important. You know, I'd like to persuade conservatives in this book, not just preach to the choir, that right, they need to take a new path. And I thought it was very important to underscore that I don't view conservatism as some evil creed. I don't view conservatives as odd creatures, because I grew up among conservatives. I tell the story in the book of my dad and I watching Ronald Reagan give his 1964 speech for Barry Goldwater. And like millions of conservatives around the country, I was 12 years old at the time. We knew this guy Reagan was the guy who was going to lead conservatives out of the wilderness. I like to think maybe it was my first good bit of punditry in my life. Starting around age 13, I started straying from conservatism. And my late dad and I had a wonderful relationship where rather than be angry at me for thinking different thoughts, he actually encouraged me to argue with him. And so political argument was actually fun and, in an odd way, bonding for the two of us. So over time, starting around the age of 13, actually, I started moving toward the left side. But the other point I want to make is that I think a healthy small d democratic system needs an intelligent form of conservatism, because we liberals can often come up with ideas that don't work and need to be challenged. I actually agree with conservatism that human nature is flawed and that you shouldn't pretend that government can completely transform human beings. The great theologian Reinhold Niebuhr once said that original sin is the only empirically verifiable doctrine of the Christian church, meaning we look around every day and realize we human beings are flawed. Government can create circumstances in which we behave better, but it cannot transform us. And so I want a better kind of conservatism in our country. And one of the people I point to whom I really would like contemporary conservatives to rediscover is Dwight Eisenhower. Yeah. And he is not, as Joe Scarborough once wrote, somebody to be looked at as a liberal in golf cleats. I mean, he was a – I think he represents the alternative form that conservatism can take, pro-business, very fiscally responsible. Obviously, he presided over a strong American foreign policy. But he understood that some of the changes liberals bring about were actually necessary and are – can be actually necessary. He accepted some of the New Deal. He understood that in a complicated society, government has a role to play in building up the economy, thus the interstate highway system, and in helping people advance, thus the federal student loan program that he established and helped millions like me go to college. So, as I say, I am a liberal, unabashed about it, but – I'd like to encourage conservatives to rethink, and maybe somebody looking in from the outside might see things that could be useful to conservatives.
We'll come back to the Dwight Eisenhower section because I think that's an important way of understanding where the movement has been and where it's headed, I guess. Let me mention this. In some ways, you see the emergence when you look at the emergence of Donald Trump. It seems like your timing was kind of perfect. But you're clear about one thing in the book. You say this isn't a campaign book.
Right. Listeners should know on behalf of my publisher that there is a lot in this book on Donald Trump.
Right.
And fortunately, I was very lucky about the timing of the book. And as Trump rose, he was fitting into the broad argument of the book. I didn't have to kind of radically change what I was doing because, as we'll get to, a lot of what Trump represents, you know, was kind of prefigured in my broader argument. But yes, it's not a campaign book because it is in many ways a history. I go all the way back to 1964 and really trace the trajectory of American politics since the Goldwater campaign, which fundamentally transformed the Republican Party. And I take readers through the Nixon administration and also the and the Reagan administration and the Clinton years and the two Bush administrations. You know, and so I hope that readers, regardless of whether they agree with me or not, and even regardless of how engaged they are now, might be able to come to the book and get a sense of how we got here, because I think there's always – I'm a journalist. I love journalism. But I think it's really important to step back and take a long view because whatever happens now is not just something that comes out of the blue. There are a lot of things that came before that got us to this point. And this book is the story of what got us to this point and this very unexpected campaign involving Donald Trump, among others.
Okay. Well, let's jump in to your thesis. Right up front in the book, you describe contemporary American conservatism as, here's how you put it, a story of disappointment and betrayal. So just broadly, EJ, lay that out for us, if you would. Conservative politicians, essentially is what you're saying, made promises to the base that they haven't been able to keep. And the rank and file are angry.
Right. And it's not surprising that they're angry. I argue that, again, because of what Goldwater promised back then, and Goldwater's complicated because he was very much an ideologue in 1964. He became somewhat more moderate later in life. In the book, I describe this wonderful moment where he endorses Bob Dole for president in 1996 to show Dole is the true conservative. And God bless him, Bob Dole can never stay on message. And he looks at Goldwater and says, hey, Barry, we're the liberals now. And Goldwater said, yeah, I guess we are the liberals, which showed how much the party had changed.
Right.
But conservative politicians since Goldwater have promised to reduce the size of government. Well, they haven't been able to do that. The government as a share of gross domestic product was almost exactly the same when Ronald Reagan left office as the day he arrived. Why can't they do that? Well, in fact, most Americans, even when they're critical of government, ask and expect rather a lot of government. Even Tea Partiers, as I note in the book, often say, don't cut Social Security or Medicare. It just so happens that an awful lot of people in the Tea Party are at over or near 65 years old. Now, they make a case these were earned benefits. But if you're not willing to make substantial cuts in Social Security and Medicare, which, by the way, I'm not either, but I'm a liberal, then you are not going to cut government down. Most conservatives seem to want an increase in defense spending. And you can go right down the list. And conservatives have just never been able to cut government the way they promised. They've never been able to roll back the cultural changes of the 1960s. If you think simply of the feminist revolution of regarding men and women as equal, the civil rights revolution of regarding people across racial lines as equal, and now with the rise of gay rights, the movement on behalf of gay rights has been extraordinary in the last 20 years. Most Americans don't want to roll back these changes. And lastly, and more recently, this is not the conservatism of Reagan or George W. Bush, but it is part of the contemporary right that Trump certainly represents, suggesting that we can change the ethnic makeup of the country by not only stopping immigration but rolling it back, deporting 11 million people, as Mr. Trump has said. This is not going to happen either. So this has created a lot of anger on the right, and it's been reflected through the Tea Party, but particularly in this campaign. One other point I'd like to make, which I think is very important about Trump. There are a lot of conservatives who've noticed over the years, former Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota, Ross Douthat, the columnist for New York Times, another conservative writer, Raihan Salam, that conservatives have gotten votes from white working class Americans, lower middle class Americans, basically people of modest means in election after election after election, and haven't done a thing for them. Their material situation has either not improved or has actually gotten worse. And I think Trump's candidacy is the revenge of such voters. If you look at where Trump is getting his votes, it tends to be downscale Republicans. He's getting a kind of he has a certain across-the-board appeal ideologically because he's a real mishmash of ideas. But his hardcore are people who've been losing out in this economy. And so I think Trump is kind of the revenge of this constituency on the Republican Party. And they're not going to contain this insurgency unless they start talking in ways that are about things more than tax cuts for the very wealthy, because this constituency knows they're not going to get very much out of that.
Yeah. One of the things you point out, and you were referring to this earlier, this idea that even Tea Partiers have a sense of, I don't know if it's contentment, but they're used to some of the reforms in the Great Society and the New Deal. And you say that the thing that set the conservative movement up for constant frustration was the fact that the country, and here's how you put it, remained operationally moderate. And in some respects, liberals. So talk about that in the sense that conservatives have been frustrated because most of the country, I guess they're like those Tea Partiers who are comfortable with some of the sort of social progress that's happened, I suppose.
There was a classic piece of political science, voting analysis done many, many years ago. I think it was in the 60s, maybe a little earlier, by two political scientists, Lloyd Free and Hadley Cantrell. And Free and Cantrell said, Americans are ideological conservatives but operational liberals. Yeah. And what they meant by that is, ideologically, yes, Americans have a real mistrust of government that indeed goes back to our revolution. They can be very critical of government. They can say, and this is often the case, the government doesn't work as well as it should. But when push comes to shove, whether it is Social Security and Medicare for the elderly, whether it is farm programs for farmers, whether it is regulation to keep the air and water clean or our consumer products safe, and you can go down a very long list, whether it's government help for people going to college. They favor an awful lot of benefits from government. And so there is this partial disconnect in the public opinion. Some elections, people are so angry at government that they vote for the anti-government party. But that anti-government party can't start pulling benefits away in a serious way because the voters don't want it to happen. And I quote Bill Clinton when he had his big budget fight with the Republicans in Congress. Why did he win that back in the 90s? Well, you know, Clinton, the Clinton administration created this Star Wars character, M2E2, Medicare, Medicaid, education, and the environment. And these were four areas where voters really didn't want things cut. And that Clinton said, you know, there was all I did here was demonstrate the laws of arithmetic, because you couldn't cut taxes as much as the Republicans wanted to without deep cuts in these programs that the public wanted. And that's the frustration. And, you know, so the question is, well, what could we do differently? Well, what we could do differently is be honest about what we want from government and decide how we're going to pay for it. And you have had these moments in the Obama years of some budget piece where instead of big ideological promises, so you had it, for example, when Paul Ryan sat down with Senator Patty Murray, Ryan a Republican, Murray a Democrat, and said, all right, you know, how can we put together a budget that kind of satisfies both sides? And they came up with a reasonable budget. Now, you know, a liberal like me thinks there are more things government should be doing. I can imagine conservatives who want to cut a little more. But these were reasonable budgets, and we didn't have shutdowns, and we didn't have threats to our credit. So this is a doable thing if we recognize that Americans want government to do the things that government needs to do.
E.J. Dionne. He's a columnist and commentator. You see him on MSNBC, hear him on NPR. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His new book is How the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, a conversation with political commentator E.J. Dionne about his new book, where he argues the American conservative movement had a tradition of prudence and balance but took a wrong turn right in around 1964 with Barry Goldwater. And since then, he says, conservative politicians have been making promises to the base that they haven't been able to keep. So the base is angry and has been marching, he says, steadily further to the right. His book is called Why the Right Went Wrong. One of the main themes in the book is what you call the road not taken by American conservatism, that there was this path, a really sort of moderate approach to ideology and to governing that Republicans tried to make work for a time. And I wanted to talk about early on in the book, you mentioned the political scientist Clinton Rossiter of Cornell. And he's writing about this in the 1950s, at these really crucial moments, and he's urging what he described as this prudent course. Now, explain what was going on at the time, because this seemed like a really critical time. The Republicans could go this way or they could go that way. But Rossiter's vision for conservatives seemed pretty appealing. The spirit of unity, blasting away at class distinctions. Talk about that.
Right. It was a form of conservatism that was, in the end, displaced by Goldwater conservatism and also the conservatism of Bill Buckley and the National Review. And I'm very respectful of Buckley in so many ways. I always say if I am 5% as effective for my side of the argument as Buckley was for his, I'll be a happy man.
Right.
So I admire Buckley, but I disagree with the course he and Goldwater took. And what they were against was Clinton Rossiter style conservatism, which was really Dwight Eisenhower style conservatism.
Yeah.
And if you want to ask who was the most effective Republican president since World War II, many of my conservative friends will say Ronald Reagan. And,
yeah,
and I understand the case they can make. But I would argue that it's actually Dwight Eisenhower. First of all, politically, he built this massive, broad Republican alliance. He managed to make inroads into the South, but also win a very large share of African-American votes. No other Republican president has been able to do that. And he did it on the basis of what you could call Edmund Burke-style conservatism. I quote Edmund Burke a lot in the book, The First Conservative, in a way, back in the 18th and 19th centuries. And that's kind of what Eisenhower represented. And if your listeners want to read a truly fascinating historical document that I've never thought got the attention it deserved, it's Eisenhower's farewell address that he gave on January 17th, 1961, 3 days before John Kennedy was inaugurated. And it's best known for its warning against the power of the military-industrial complex. But the speech as a whole was a powerful plea for balance and prudence. Ike was unapologetic about using the word balance over and over again. He called for balance in and among national programs, balance between the public and the private economy, balance between the cost and the hoped-for advantages, between the clearly necessary and the comfortably desirable, a balance between the actions of the moment and the national welfare of the future. That, to me, defines a good government in general. I think people, regardless of their ideology, can embrace a lot of those thoughts. But I particularly think it's a form of conservatism because, again, Burke said that the statesman should have a desire to preserve but an inclination to improve. A real conservatism doesn't pretend that there are no problems to solve, doesn't pretend that government is always the enemy and always ineffectual. That's reaction. That is not conservatism. And so I think that the Goldwater campaign upended this alternative form of conservatism. And while obviously we can't go back to the 1950s, we can't exactly go back to Eisenhower, I do believe that certain figures in our history lay out ideas that live beyond them. Certainly Lincoln did. One of my favorite unsung presidents, John Quincy Adams, did. And I think Dwight Eisenhower did.
You quote some of that farewell speech, concludes with this: in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love. And when you
have a lot of that in our politics these days, don't we?
But when you look at the condition of the American economy, which you referenced earlier in under the Eisenhower administration, the shape of the American middle class in particular, I mean, this is a good argument, it seems, for, and it seemed like a fairly effective blueprint for governing in that time.
I do think so. And that's why I think that is ultimately the path that Republicans and conservatives could take. And I think we could have a more productive argument. There was a time when people could have argument that wasn't of the sort we have now, where people really consign their opponents to some terrible place in hell. I mean, you see it online all the time. And, you know, I'm very much for vigorous argument. And I'm welcome when people want to trash me online. That's the price of admission for getting to do what I do. So I'm not resentful of it personally, but it's not very productive for us collectively. And I think that a form of Eisenhower conservatism matched against a moderately social democratic liberalism could really move us forward. We could start arguing about how to solve problems. And, you know, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., a great liberal, said something that I think should, again, appeal to a lot of people, which is he said politics should be about remedy. It should be about the search for remedy. You know, and I wrote that in my book all the way back to my book, Why Americans Hate Politics, 25 years ago. And I still think we are crying out for a politics of remedy.
Of course, the idea goes the problem goes back a long way, as you mentioned. It's a an ideological force rooted in history and goes back to Goldwater, which we'll get to. But you begin with in the book with a discussion of Ronald Reagan, whom you describe as the movement's ambiguous hero. Why start with Reagan?
Well, I started with Reagan because he is so clearly the central figure of the conservative imagination right now. And I thought that the ambiguities of Reagan really illustrated quite well the problems that conservatives are having in sorting their way forward. That right at the beginning of the book, As I think I mentioned, one of the things I did for this book is interview a whole lot of conservatives before I started. And they all knew that I was a liberal and that they were unlikely to convert me. But they accepted me at my word that I was actually trying to understand what has happened to this great tradition. And one of the people I talked to was Charles Krauthammer, my fellow columnist at The Washington Post and the Fox News analyst. And he had a wonderful line, which is, you can choose your Reagan. And his point was, and my point is, that there is the Reagan who was the movement builder, who gave that speech for Barry Goldwater that was down the line ideological, critical of Social Security, of farm programs, of pretty much government and all its works, saying that essentially if LBJ won, the country would keep moving towards socialism. He actually quoted the socialist Norman Thomas to make his point. And then there was the Reagan who governed. Now, Reagan, I think, and I do believe for his legacy, this turned out to be a blessing for him. Reagan governed with the Democrats in control of the House, even as he had to deal with the Democratic legislature as governor. And Reagan was not afraid to compromise. He was not afraid to change course. He put through one of the largest tax cuts in American history. And then later on in his administration realized that the tax cut had gone too far and pulled it back. Congress voted one of the largest tax increases in American history. It didn't roll back the whole Reagan tax cut, but it took back a lot of revenue into the federal government. And he was willing to do that because there was a pragmatic streak and he wanted to be a successful president, not simply a conservative president. And, you know, his greatest apostasy from conservatism in some ways was his embrace of Mikhail Gorbachev. You know, to the horror of many conservatives at the time, Ronald Reagan said, no, this guy is different. He really wants to make peace and change the Soviet Union. And so I suppose in a way in my chapter, I might confound both liberals and conservatives because I argue it's not necessarily Reagan the warrior who won the Cold War, as conservatives would like to argue. It may have been Reagan the peacenik who really actually hated nuclear weapons, wanted to get rid of them, and took this gamble on Gorbachev that turned out to be a very good gamble to take.
Richard Nixon is an interesting example, and I think there are some threads that align with Reagan in some ways. You say early in the book that everything about Richard Nixon, of course, is complicated, and that's certainly true with his relationship with American conservatives. But let's talk about that, because you say that there was something going on in the 1968 campaign, the battle that's going on among Nixon and his campaign advisors. And in some ways, that seemed to sort of set the stage, you say, or provide a model for the battles that are still relevant today. Would you talk about Nixon, where he fits in this story?
Right. Nixon is and always will be a fascinating figure. And it's worth noting that when Nixon was first elected to Congress in 1946, Chris Matthews wrote a wonderful book years ago about Kennedy and Nixon. And if you looked at their campaign literature, Kennedy described himself as a conservative and Nixon described himself as a liberal, Kennedy running as a Democrat, Nixon as a Republican.
Right.
And Nixon was clearly an Eisenhower Republican. He was Ike's vice president. He was very loyal to Eisenhower. Eisenhower wasn't quite as loyal to Nixon as I think Nixon was to Ike. And he ran in 1960 very much as a moderate. He was a big supporter of civil rights, Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
Was, for example. But then along came Goldwater, and when Nixon was making his comeback in 1968, he realized that the center of gravity in his party had moved sharply to the right, that he needed very strong support from at least part of the right wing of the Republican Party if he was going to win that nomination. And that's where Pat Buchanan came in. And
yeah.
Pat Buchanan, whom I interviewed for the book and who also wrote, actually, whether you may disagree with Buchanan on everything, but his book on Nixon's comeback in 68, a book called The Greatest Comeback, is a really fine account of how Nixon did this. And so Nixon had on the one side his conservative staff, Buchanan being one of them,
right,
because he was always conscious of the new importance of the South, the Southern conservatives in the Republican Party. And I talk a lot in my book about the Southernization of the party. But there was still part of him drawn back to the old Eisenhower Republicanism. And so there were these real battles within Nixon's 68 campaign staff where the conservatives wanted him to be really hard line on crime, on race, on student disorder, on campuses. And the more moderate voices said, well, no, but you don't want to look like the old sort of anti-communist Nixon whom liberals loathe. And they had this battle all the way through the campaign. And Nixon's presidency reflected this contradiction or this struggle because – on the one hand, he did pursue the Southern strategy. Yeah. He did go after the Democrats on social issues. He realigned. He began, realignment in our politics of white working class voters. And yet it was also Nixon who had the opening to China, which, of course, conservatives loathed, right, who signed a raft of progressive legislation put on his desk by Democrats. It was Nixon who signed the law creating the Environmental Protection Agency, Nixon who created the Occupational Safety and Health Administration for Safety at Work. And so you had this really complex figure from beginning to end. And Nixon didn't end the Vietnam War fast enough for progressives, and I was an anti-war person back in those days, and yet he did eventually get American troops out of Vietnam. And so and there was a real rebellion against him on the right in 1972, but it came to nothing, and a lot of conservatives, though not all, came around to supporting Nixon.
You mentioned there's a section on Jimmy Carter, of course, who I think there was some sense of hope for Jimmy Carter coming out of those Watergate times. But Carter alienates the cold warriors in the Democratic Party. Many defected. So I'm guessing that you're seeing the sort of the opportunities for Jimmy Carter as he didn't take much advantage of them in some ways. Is that how you're sort of assessing the Carter presidency?
Well, I mean, Jimmy Carter ended up, in fairness to Jimmy Carter, he ended up getting dealt a very difficult hand, because this was the era of stagflation, where the economy was starting to get stagnant and we had inflation. Now, obviously, he's the guy in charge, although the president doesn't entirely control the Federal Reserve. So that happened. And then, of course, the hostage crisis happened and which just was a pall on his entire presidency. The Soviets invade Afghanistan. But Jimmy Carter himself, in 1976, he won the nomination by defeating every wing of the Democratic Party. He defeated the liberals, represented by Mo Udall, the right-wing southern part of the party, by defeating George Wallace, the Cold Warriors, by defeating Scoop Jackson. But that also meant that he had no natural base inside his own party, and he alienated both the Cold Warriors by being more peace-minded, if you will, in his foreign policy than they wanted. But he also alienated the liberals. Remember, it was Ted Kennedy ran a primary against him because he didn't embrace national health insurance or a number of liberal goals. So Jimmy Carter was left sort of friendless, not entirely friendless, obviously, but with a lot of enemies on his own side of politics. And that happened at a time when he was facing a series of crises, not all of which were his fault. And that's what opened the way to Ronald Reagan. I think it's very important for conservatives to accept the notion that when Americans voted for Ronald Reagan in 1981, he got 51% of the vote in that first election, not 60%, because John Anderson ran as an independent, kind of splitting off some of the moderate Republicans and also some anti-Carter Democrats. But he won because voters were just fed up with the situation the country was in. When you have 21% interest rates, people aren't going to be happy. And so voters were perfectly willing to buy supply-side economics. But here's what Reagan did do that I think today's conservatives need to look back on. Reagan was relentlessly hopeful and optimistic about America's future. As I write in the book, I mean, Reagan stole optimism from FDR, and it took Bill Clinton to steal it back from Reagan. And I think when you look at these Republican debates this year, there is such deep gloom about America as it is, about America where we stand. And sure, the party out of power is always gloomy about what's going on when the other side controls the White House. You know, but objectively speaking, we're a country that on the one hand has some deep problems, and I keep coming back to the problems facing less well-off Americans in this new economy, which is, I think, the crisis both parties have to deal with. But we're also, when you look around the world, who wouldn't want to be us? That our economy fared far better in this economic catastrophe that started in 2008 than almost any other country in the world. I would really say any other country in the world. We've had more growth. You know, our businesses are in stronger shape. Our spirit of entrepreneurship is there. Our unemployment rate is lower. And in terms of the diversity of our country, Lord, that's been a strength of ours throughout our history. And you know, I sometimes say to my conservative friends, you know, I want you to sort of believe in the American idea as much as I do. And obviously I'm saying that partly to annoy them. But what I mean by that is that, you know, when I look at new immigrants who have come in, I really believe that there is an overarching American idea that transforms all of us, no matter where we're from. And if you go back to, you know, my people came down over the border from Quebec in Canada. It's not all that different from people coming north from Mexico. Italians, Irish, Jews, all kinds of people came into our country. At the time, people said, oh, they will change the country. America won't be America anymore. Guess what? We all became Americans. French was actually my first language. We lived in an ethnic town in Massachusetts, and my parents wanted to keep the ancestral language alive with the kids. But I challenge I am as red, white, and blue, I think, as anybody else, and am as big a baseball fan as my friend George Will.
E.J. Dionne. His book is Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with E.J. Dionne. We were talking about his new book, Why the Right Went Wrong. There's this self-reinforcing process that you describe. Of course, Barry Goldwater, that movement is a response to what's going on. Ultimately, you know, a reaction to the New Deal, among other things, and the moderates in the party, which gives us Nixon, which collapses, eventually gives us Reagan. The defeat of Bush Sr. brings the Gingrich Revolution. Bill Clinton brings George W. Bush. And the Tea Party has given way somehow to Donald Trump. So there's this sort of, I don't know, are you seeing it as a sort of linear sense of progress, this sort of cycle of radicalization? Is it headed along a linear kind of line? Is it headed in one direction as you see it?
I think it was a philosopher, Isaiah Berlin, who referred to the crooked timber of humanity. And I think in history, most lines are crooked. There are a few straight lines. But yes, I do see it, a crooked line moving in a particular direction. You know, I talk a lot about the lost opportunity of the George W. Bush years. Yeah. And I write quite a lot in the book about compassionate conservatism. Where, you know, if you looked at what Bush and Karl Rove were up to, they understood that the old attacks on the Democrats wouldn't work as well as they used to because Bill Clinton engineered some changes inside the Democratic Party that made the Democratic Party a less easy target. And they also understood that the Gingrich Congress had become very unpopular. So Bush was really, you know, Clinton, it was said, was trying to create a third way between the old liberalism and the old conservatism. And Bush initially was trying to create a kind of fourth way, where he was critical of certain actions Congress took, Republicans took in Congress, cutting spending on the poor. They were largely symbolic critiques, but nonetheless, he made them. He talked a lot about a compassionate form of conservatism. He tried to make the education issue into a Republican issue and was very proud of the fact that where Democrats and Bill Clinton had a huge advantage on the education issue in 1996 by talking about it incessantly and proposing his own reforms, Bush cut that advantage to almost zero in the 2000 election. But Bush's reform project lost its way. Obviously, it became secondary in importance after the attacks of 9/11
right.
and the Iraq War and everything that happened after that. But Bush himself and Karl Rove kind of gave up on the project when they realized that even though they were pursuing this moderate strategy, they still lost the popular vote to Al Gore in 2000. And Rove commissioned a study where he decided at the end that there wasn't enough there weren't enough movable voters in the middle. So what started out as a very interesting Bush reform project sort of, I think, was kind of partially halted in the middle. He did a few things. He did pass No Child Left Behind, and he did pass the prescription drug benefit. One of the other ironies of this story is the Tea Party began formally under Obama, but Tea Party sentiments began to appear at the end of the Bush administration. Yeah. And conservatives wanted to explain what the country saw as, at that time, a failed administration. The Iraq War became very unpopular. The economy blew up. They didn't want to say, well, it was because Bush was too conservative or because this Iraq policy was a disaster. So they started arguing that Bush failed because he was a big government conservative, and never mind that the big government spending was mostly in Basra or Baghdad and not in Biloxi or Buffalo. And they, you know, and that they talked about the prescription drug benefit, although they didn't really try to repeal it. And that was the new talk. And of course, immigration again, where Bush really did embrace immigration reform. He got about 40% of the Latino vote. And that was seen later as a great sin. So the Tea Party sentiment, you know, I cite some very interesting writing by a conservative called Chris Colwell on this, really was visible in the Bush years, and then it just took off in the Obama years.
But the thing I want to kind of go back to where Karl Rove and George W. Bush sort of ditch this compassionate conservatism in some ways and figured really the best thing to do, I guess, in the short term was just, you know, throw more red meat and rally the faithful. What was it that he was seeing after they'd lost the popular vote that made them think that way? And why doesn't that sort of bolster what conservatives are thinking today, that in order to get any kind of success, you have to head right? Yeah.
Just to be fair to Bush, there are two things I want to underscore that he did that I think are admirable and consistent with compassionate conservatism. One is a speech he gave a few days after 9/11 at the Islamic Center here in D.C., where he declared in the strongest possible language that our fellow Americans who are Muslims are fellow Americans. And right. he really pushed hard against any effort to blanket blame Muslims for attacks by extremists. That was very important. And, you know, Jeb Bush just dropped out of the race. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most honorable things he did in this whole campaign was to push back against a kind of Islamophobia that really hurts us in the world and is not consistent with our great tradition of religious freedom. The other thing Bush inaugurated was PEPFAR, the program to help eradicate AIDS in Africa. And that was a big deal. That was his real shining, compassionate conservative moment. But you're quite right that he largely abandoned this. And I think the political instinct was that Rove looked at 2000 and he estimated that perhaps 3 or 4 million evangelical Christians didn't turn out to vote and that he had failed to rally some of the traditional conservative base. And so after the initial state court rulings on behalf of gay marriage, he made Bush into the anti-gay marriage candidate. And that indeed did rally the evangelicals. The other thing is that compassionate conservatism never had much purchase among Republicans in Congress. One of the people I had really long, productive conversation with is another, actually, of my Post colleagues, Mike Gerson, who was Bush's chief speechwriter, who was very frustrated that you could talk, he could talk blue in the face about compassionate conservatism, and the Republican Congress really didn't want to go there. They mostly just wanted to use the issue to say Democrats don't like religion. They don't want to give any aid to any of these religious group. So I think those two facts, the political need to rally the base, became more important, and the fact that compassionate conservatism always seems to take – whenever ideas like this come along, it always takes a backseat, maybe even in the trunk with the trunk closed, as a priority within the Republican Party and the conservative movement.
A big part of the book, of course, is this question you keep asking, and that is whether or not American conservatism as a movement can be reformed. It seems like you don't hold out a lot of hope in some ways. I mean, you say the reformers are constrained by history. They're constrained by the current makeup of the party. And you say early in the book that any shift away from this, you know, the utopian purity of the conservative movement is going to have to be much bolder than reformers are willing to contemplate right now. How much hope do you hold out for a reform for conservatism?
Well, they have to be more bold than either they want to be or believe they can be within the current constraints imposed by the nature of the Republican constituency and the forces in the party. And by the way, I do talk quite a bit about talk radio and Fox and also the radical rich, what David Frum on the radio TV side refers to as the conservative entertainment complex.
Right.
But my sources of hope are as follows. There is a conservative economist called Herb Stein, and he offered Stein's law, which was if things can't keep going on the way they are, they won't. One obvious mechanism for change would be a defeat in this election, in the presidential election, with a staunch conservative at the helm. I mean, if Ted Cruz, for example, won the Republican nomination, that probably looks a little less likely today than it might have a few weeks ago. But the conservatives couldn't say this is some squishy Republican in name only. He would be the real deal. If he lost, I think that would create some space for some rethinking in the party. But it's also the case that a lot of smart Republicans and conservatives know that in – and I quote a lot of them in the book – that given the demographic change in the country, they can't stay like they are and expect to win elections 10, 20 years down the road unless people are simply excluded from the electorate, because young people, the future of politics does not belong to the old. The old pass on to their eternal reward, and the young come along and reshape politics. Young Americans are far more progressive than older Americans, which wasn't the case before. In the book, I cite some Pew numbers. When Reagan was president in 1987, only 39% of conservatives were over 50. In 2014, 53% were, and that number is going up. In a country that is becoming increasingly diverse, you cannot court enormous hostility from Latinos and Asians and expect to remain a majority party. So I am counting in the end on political self-interest and common sense to lead conservatives to revisit some of the positions they have now. And that's why I try from the other shore, if you will, from the other political shore, to lay out a path that I think they could take that I think would be good for them and good for the country.
I want to get to that. But let me just ask you, where does Trump fit in your theory? Some think this way, that he's not a conventional conservative in any way. Where does he fit in the theory? And what's the lesson, let's say he gets nominated? What's the lesson he's going to provide for your story, for your theory?
Yes, I think Trump may prove to be as complicated as Nixon, though in very different ways. If Trump wins the nomination, he is clearly overthrowing a lot of traditionally conservative ideas. And indeed, that could actually bring about a split in the party. I did an event on my book with Bill Kristol, the conservative editor and thinker, who said that if Trump were the Republican nominee, he would want conservatives to put up a third party candidate. In fact, he said he'd love a four candidate election with Bloomberg also running. And I pointed out that the last time we had a four party election was in 1860, and then we had a civil war. So I wasn't sort of as keen on that as Bill was.
Right.
But I think you could have a split in the party. That's certainly one possibility. I think parts of the party would go along with Trump because, after all, you know, their candidates are on the ballot as Republicans, so a split could endanger them. But I think Trump is very much a product of this crisis I am talking about,
yeah.
because as I say, he's on immigration and some of those issues, some of the issues related to race and crime. He is very much an old-fashioned right winger, but on some of the populist economics, he is in a very different place. It just happens that there is a sizable chunk of the Republican constituency that agrees with him on both sets of positions.
The only way to end the cycle, you say, is to stop making promises they can't keep. And you say that they're going to have to accept in practice what many acknowledge already in theory, that regulation is important, that the government has to play some sort of role in caring for people, that they're going to have to acknowledge a sense of tolerance, a sense of compromise. Because you see, that's not antithetical to conservatism, as we've already talked about. There's a tradition in conservatism that talks about prudence and talks about balance. Can they do it? Can they get there?
Well, two figures out of the 2012 campaign I lift up in the book, and they seem contradictory. One was John Huntsman, your former governor, who was, you might say, the candidate of upscale cultural modernization. And I think the Republican Party does need that element of greater tolerance and openness to the country as it is. On the other end, Rick Santorum was the candidate of the working class social conservatives who also talked to the Sam's Club Republicans who have now rallied to Donald Trump. And these may seem in contradiction, but I think the two things conservatives need to do are to take a turn toward cultural moderation and embrace those who have been
left out.
Yeah. What I argue at the end of the book that, conservatives rightly revere those who came before us, but they will not prosper if they keep yearning for a past. They're never going to be able to call back to life. They can't just celebrate the America that once was. I'm proposing that they embrace the vibrant nation that we are now and are becoming. And I found this wonderful quote from Ike, as I say, one of my heroes, Republican heroes. He said, "Neither a wise man nor a brave man lies down on the tracks of history to wait for the train of the future to run over him." Mm-hmm. And I think conservatives need to look at the country as it is now and look at the future with more confidence than they have, and at the risk of sounding a little bit like Barack Obama, I think they need to have more hope in the country as it is.
E.J. Dionne. His book is Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. He joined us from a studio at Georgetown University, where he teaches at the McCourt School of Public Policy. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.